Namaste. Yeah, I want to make sure I don't have any echo on this thing. I sound like I'm talking in a tunnel or something. We had a very good talk this morning with what's going on with everyone. Everyone is making progress. So that's good. And I want to welcome you all to come to Satsang today. Thank you. Namaste. It's very good to see you all here. It's good to be back in Seattle with you. And I think that this format, and through the week, I know when people come here, some, like Premadas says, when you get here, sometimes you go into some sort of a stillness and the questions just go right out. Right out of the mind. So if you have questions that pop up during the week, something you'd like to see covered in satsang, just go ahead and write them down and then bring them, and we'll keep a little bowl. Keep the little bowl out here by the satsang chair, and just put your questions in or the flow that you want to see for that week, what direction, if there's a specific subject that you'd like to see covered, and then we can go ahead and do that. And for the people that are in the other parts of the world, if you want to email me a question, I will put it in the bowl for you and answer it as well in satsang, and we'll get the CDs made, and I will list them on the site so people that want CDs, they can go ahead and request them, and we'll have them sent out. So we'll see if we can go ahead and put online what the questions of the satsang are for that time. So if it's a CD that you're interested in, then you can request it, and we'll get someone to send it out to you. So we're trying to implement a little bit more where more people can be involved, because not everyone can be physically at all the satsangs, and people have requested what's going on. So we'll see about that. And we have lots of questions today and lots of directions, and we'll just go through the through our little bowl. Okay, this is concerning the new energy practice that I've been giving out to those that have taken Diksha. And the question is, I just read the practice and I go out when reading it, so what to do? This is a strong practice, okay? If you can't even make it through the reading of it, you're out. then what I suggest is you stay afterwards, and I'll go through it with you and see if we can get you through the practice once. But if you go out even reading it, then that's fine. That's all you need, because it's obviously it's moving you into that space very rapidly. So, but hopefully we can get it implemented. So eventually, then you break out and you go into the full nirvikalpa, and then that's it. You're so close now. I know that you've gone into that realization, and it just keeps coming back, and mind keeps wanting to try to reroute. So this is what we need to work on with you, is to get you out of that rerouting. That's why I haven't pronounced full enlightenment yet. You've definitely tasted it, but we need to get you to that point of where the mind's not rerouting, and that takes a while. Takes a while. Sometimes. Weed killer. Mind killer. Yeah, what happens is, that the identity, and one keeps looking, and that identity and that meanness wants to come back and reroute. So you start externalizing again and focusing on something externalized, and then once again it's trying to put those roots in the ground of that meanness. So this is why it's important just to continue on with the practice until that totally falls away. And then what comes up will just be like, you know, the clouds across the sky. That it will be empty in nature, and then there will be no longer any rooting to it whatsoever. But that can happen with some people, you know. Some people can enter into a nirvikalpa. Things can just simply fall away, and there is no me, there is no. And like she was saying, she goes downstairs and just touched the doorknob of the basement, and all of a sudden, there's just one. There's just one. There's no divisionary whatsoever. And people can go in and out of this for a time until they get stabilized. This happens with a few people. The thing is, at this point, not to give up on the practice, to continue, because it needs to stabilize. It's not good enough just to have one experience of the absolute. It needs to be ongoing, your reality. And you know, at that point, when you have one experience of it, you know it's reality. But if the mind reroutes, then what happens? You get back into that, you know, you're bouncing back and forth between reality and Maya, between Leela and Maya, Leela, Maya, Leela, Maya. Yeah, in a day's time, you can be bouncing back and forth. So this is why it's important at that point to continue with the meditations, to continue until it just... the rest of that little last lingering root is cut. When you begin the activity, when you come out of meditation, you start an activity, it comes back up into play, the mind. Yeah. And yeah, sometimes when you get involved in something, then once again it falls away as well. Yeah, yeah. So if its mind is coming up, then you immediately go stop. And yeah, I'm just sitting, or you go into the one thing at a time and allow that to fall away, rather than starting to chase this externalization that's going to attempt to reroot itself. So yeah, some people, you know, this is why they talk about there are three levels of jivanmukti. One is the one that's always in total non-duality, and just none of the rest of it comes back whatsoever. These are the ones that are like Ramana. He is just totally in non-duality all the time. But he is... you know, he's not doing any activity. He's just there and maintaining that. But they say that that's not the best state. The best state is to be the middle one of jivanmukti, whereas you're active in the world, yet you're unhindered by it. Where it becomes, everything just becomes empty in nature. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The third one, you know, because then you're not gravitating through mind. It's, you know, you just see it like a cloud that's coming and going. It doesn't matter. There's no attachment to it. Yeah, yeah, there's functioning in the world. Yeah, it's a tool at that point. When you're not using it, it's not working. It's just silent. There's stillness. Yeah. So that's the best state. That's the best state. And the third one is the one that's jivanmukti. They've had an experience where it's falling away. They know the absolute is supreme reality. There's no way to deny it. But then the mind reroots, and they're once again caught up in the maya, in the sorrow, in the suffering and bondage. So even though they know what's the truth, they say this type of jivanmukti is really, you cannot say too much that it's jivanmukti. The rest of the falling away will happen at their death, when they drop the body. Then they'll go into a fully expanded state. So these are the ones that can talk about it, but they haven't had chance to settle. They haven't had, you know, it's not a living, ongoing presence for them. The mind can reroute. This is what you see a lot of people that are on a lot of these lines. They've had a quick glimpse of it. But then they come back and say, well, you get Jivan Mukti and you get realization, then you need to come back and work on all this stuff. No, a full Jivan Mukti, there's nothing left to work on. All the conditionings, everything fall away immediately, that's it, it's the end of it. So if something is still coming up to be worked on, you've had a glimpse of it, and the mind has rerouted. So yeah, in that case, there's more work to do. They need to do more meditation, not sit there and philosophize about it and think they've got it and then end too quickly. This is what happened. A lot of them, they might get a glimpse and they end too quickly. They think, well, I've already got it, I know it. Yeah. Okay, what was just talked about was about doing the meditation, and then you come out and you find yourself having to function in the world. What we want to do is come to a point where that meditation is ongoing. You reach a point where you're meditating without meditating. This is why I tell people, you know, do one thing at a time, and you'll go into an active meditation. People ask if Guru meditates. Well, it's, you know, it's like an active meditation. If I stop and I quit externalizing and I spend 1 second looking at that tree, I'll be gone. It's that quick. For me, I keep externalizing, so I can dampen down the mind to more mundane consciousness so that I can work with people. You reach to that level, and it's ongoing. This is I think Madhu is so what I'm going to do is pass the mic to you so that we can get this on the tape, because it's very hard for people that are not here. And I'm trying to reiterate what's being said. It's like, we need to get a 2-mic system and pass it around to people, and that would be the easiest. So yeah, if you could go ahead and just if you could explain this one more time for those, that will help.
The same. It just seems like in meditation, certain states I can get into that I just feel like I don't even want to budge from that, and just even taking care of my regular needs or going to brush my teeth or whatever. I mean, I really wouldn't mind sitting there the whole, always. And it's just, you know, I get up and I do my thing. I'm not worried about it or anything. It's just, that's kind of a feeling that I just don't care if I do much of anything, really. And it's not apathy. It's just feeling just right there. But is it okay to ask the question now that I was going to ask? I was wondering that when the consciousness feels so expanded, in terms, should there be a focus? I mean, it seems like it goes outward, it kind of fills the room and that kind of thing. I just kind of let it be and flow, but I wonder, should there be a focus on the heart center or the body, or should I just sort of leave whatever?
No, if you reach that expanded state, just allow that to be as it is. Because otherwise, then once again, you're going to become more body consciousness. So what we have people do is, in first becoming aware of the heart center, is to draw them more into bhakti and more of an expanded state and give them a point of reference to begin to expand. But once you've expanded out there, then you're expanded. Okay, so there's no reason to do that, because you will at that point feel that, you know, that sarvakalpa samadhi, that bliss will start coming in anyway. You're welcome. So I think we're ready for the next one here in the bowl. Onward and upward. Oh, this is a good one. What is sin? Ooh. Now this. Yeah, the latent Christian Jehovah Witness. What a sin! Yeah, sin. I mean, even the Bible speaks of this to some degree. Sin is separation. Okay, it means nothing more than separation. If you're in sin, you're in feeling of separation or in duality. Okay, that there's you and there's God. That's sin. There is no you and God. There is only God. Okay? So sin is nothing more than separation. And if you're doing things that they call sinful, what happens? You're winding up harming yourself. You're putting into motion negative karma. You're collecting a lot of garbage. And you feel even more separate. So ultimately, sin is nothing more than separation into I and other. It's also, you know, everything comes from truth. Ultimately, it has to have a seed in the absolute or truth. Even the most negative of things, like somebody that's got a really perverse sexual nature, what they're searching for is love, ultimately, or some sort of the satisfaction, but it's been so pulled away from the reality of that truth that it appears to be extremely negative. But they're still seeking that reality, that seed reality of that, where there's only that one. They're seeking that bliss, they're seeking, you know, the connection. So sin ultimately is nothing more than separation into duality. There are degrees of it at that point. So this is what you come to. You know, if you come to that moment where that switch is flipped, that you know you're not the body, mind, or emotions, it's like the Bible says, you feel like you've been reborn, that you're just that clear, that perfection. And you have an awareness of that. But when you reach realization, it's even deeper than that. You know, this is another stage you can go through before realization, where all of a sudden you find out that I'm clean, I'm pure, that I'm only spirit, and nothing can touch spirit. So, yeah. So that's, you know, people are looking for that union. They're looking for that one. So all sin is nothing more than separation into duality. Realization is entering the non-dual. There's only God. There's nothing other than that. It's the best answer for sin you've ever gotten. You'll accept that one? Now we're not going to name off all of the numerous ways that you can enter separation. Yeah, well, yeah, no. We don't need to go there where, yeah, no. That's from the Bible. Sin is separation. That's it. Boom. And it's, you know, it's not such a big horrible, you know, thing like people want to say. You know, people enter hell realms. Why? So that's where their consciousness is. It's not that they're being condemned to it. It's where the only place that they can go. That's where their consciousness is. But you can be in a hell realm on earth. You can be in a hell realm now. So this is, you know, this is another thing that Christ was always speaking to. You know, you need to go within and find the heavenlies is within. It's here. It's now. It's present. It's not something you're going to gravitate to later. It's here now. You need to find it here now. It's possible here now. This was a lot of his message when he was here, you know?
I was just saying that it's pretty amazing reading the Bible a second time after you've gotten a lot of those Sunday school filters. out, and you're able to just, you can see Jesus as being an enlightened person, you know. And a lot of things he says, if you look at it, it's not any different than what, you know, Buddha was saying or anything else. It's just been, sometimes it's been tweaked to fit certain doctrines that people come up with. But at the end of the day, he's not condemning people, and he's usually pretty open about to anyone. He just says, you know, like you're saying, it's, sin is not something that, I guess the Mosaic Law and what Jesus taught were obvious to some degree, different. But yeah, I mean, he seemed very, very open to people, and yeah, so.
Yeah, absolutely. He did not condemn anyone. That came up with the religious hierarchy later. The condemnation, he always spoke against condemnation. What happened when they brought the harlot up? He who is without sin cast the first stone. He was not into condemning. He never condemned. He never condemned. So yeah, he was a great guru. He was an enlightened being. He was a master. But this whole thing that, you know, they have now, you have to believe on him. He never set himself up to be a separate religion. Never. This has happened with churchiology. So much of his message, which was so freeing, has become a bondage because of misinterpretation and because of putting another slant on it. So let's go on to the next one if we covered that. What types of active meditation, and what's this last word? Is that yours? All right, if you can come up closer so that I can pass you the mic as we go. What types are there? Oh, okay. What type of active meditations are there? As many as you can devise. Anything can be an active meditation. Doesn't matter if it's washing the dishes, if it's raking leaves, if it's making chai. Look at the tea ceremony. Huh? They turn just simply making tea into an active meditation. So this is why I stress doing one thing at a time and not having a lot of mental drama coming up surrounding it as you're working. Just do the one thing at a time with attention and intention, and it can come into an active meditation. It can draw you into a meditative still state.
Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about the walking meditation, and he even mentioned telephone meditation, where he was talking about, you know, loving speech can transform a lot of people.
Absolutely. This is why you come to satsang, because a transmission happens. Guru is in that active state of stillness. It transmits. Yes, an active state of stillness. You like that one? Yeah, good. So that transmission happens. This is why sometimes when you come, you're full of questions and all of a sudden the mind stills. A transmission takes place. It can take place through words. Sometimes I will be on an internet chat and people will go into stillness from the words that are spoken. Sometimes just even reading it, they will go into a stillness because there is a transmission that happens.
In sports, they call it getting into the zone. Like when I was younger playing sports, they'd always say, you got to get in that zone. When you're in that zone, you just respond to whatever. You're not thinking about what you're doing. That's an active meditation right there. A lot of people don't realize they're doing.
Absolutely. This is why there are so many athletes that are just so driven by it, because they get into the zone. Huh? And yeah, they perform the best because it's no longer them doing something. There's just that activity taking place. There's no separation between them and that activity. They go into a sort of a oneness at that point. They're feeling an underlying current of that oneness. So, yeah. Yeah, musicians, any type of an artist can get into that, any type. And it doesn't even matter art. You know, you can do that in anything. You know, if you lose yourself in functioning, if you're working with people, and you lose yourself in that, it's not you interrelating with it, it's just that energy that's going on. It doesn't matter what you're doing. Even driving a car. If you're a driver, you can enter into that. You know, it doesn't matter what you're doing, what activity, what your position in life. It doesn't matter. This can happen across the spectrum, across the board. This is what I want to see. I want this to become a living sadhana. Every breath can be a moment of spiritual practice. It can be a communing. Every moment can be sacred if the mind is in that direction. If it's surrendered in that bhakti, surrendered in karma yoga, that it can enter into that divine sacred space. Every moment, every breath is an opportunity to enter into that divine space. Okay. Next question. Ah, the sannyas path. Elaborate on the sannyasi path. This is another area which we are attempting to update, one thing that I want to see updated in the world. Sannyas is taking that vow that your life is dedicated to the path, your life is dedicated to God, your life is dedicated to reaching realization and liberation. That's taking of sannyas. It's renunciation. Renunciation of chasing after the world. Renunciation of looking for the fruits of the world. Doesn't mean that you have to throw everything away and go wandering. Doesn't mean that you're constricted to orange clothing. This is one of the things I want to break through with a lot of, especially Indian devotees and things, that they have this idea of sannyas and guru and, you know, that you have to be on this pedestal and untouchable and, you know, all of this other drama that goes on. It needs to be broken through. We're moving into another time. The world does not support people wandering around living on alms. So it needs to go through a revision. It needs to be changed. Sannyas is of the heart. It should be of the heart, not of the clothing. So yes, sannyas is possible. It's possible in life. People can commit to the path and take sannyas. I think sannyas is even possible in a marriage situation if the partners are committed to the spiritual path. Above all things, their commitment is there. And then you can help each other. And when you transcend, then you can go forward as a couple and help the world and show a very healthy dynamic. So this is sannyas that I want to see put into place. This is sannyas. It's 100% commitment to God, to path, to realization. The world is secondary. The world is part of your path. Your path is not secondary to the world. That's sannyas. It's an inner commitment. And once you take sannyas, there's no getting out of sannyas. Once you take that vow, the world will work with you. And if you start getting off the path, Ma Kali is going to slam you. Boom. So this is something that needs to be looked at in your heart. It needs to be taken seriously. But yes, sannyas in our case is open to male and female alike. Sannyasis are called swami, means lord. Lord of what? Working on becoming lord of your own emotions, lord of this. Not lord over the world, not lording over other people. Dedicated to the Lord, lording of your own emotions, your own conditionings breaking through. It's respect, it's reverence for what you're doing. This is why people use the term Swami. Honor the commitment that you're making to break through, because when you break through, then you should bring it back to the world to help others. It's a serious commitment. So sannyas is this. I hope to see many more sannyasis. When you take the name and when you take sannyas, you get a new name. Becomes something Anand. The bliss of whatever direction. In my case, it happens to be Kali Uttamananda. Kali Uttamananda means the bliss of being fully realized yet functional in the world. That's Uttamananda. The bliss of being realized yet fully functional in the world. And the energy that I project is Kali. Very strong, just straightforward, boom, that's it. It's like Swamiji was saying when I was down there, our energies are very different. People comment on that a lot when I go down there. His is just very, you know, la-da-da-da-da, Ganeshi, you know, just, you know, very, you know, he's more in that bliss and whatever. And mine's just straightforward, boom, cut to the chase. He said my energy is very much like Muktananda's was. Just, you walk into the room, it's just boom, his presence is there, boom. So everyone has a little bit of a different aspect and energy that they bring to this and the way they function. Not everyone can relate to me. Not everyone can relate to Swamiji Swarupananda. Not everyone can relate to Krishna. Some relate better to Shiva. Some relate better to... So everyone has a different, you know, it's a little bit of a different energetic dynamic that happens with them. But yeah, I hope to see more people committing to the path of sannyas. So is there any other questions concerning that? Well, then we'll move on. Talk about heart expansion. Well, we went into a little bit about this. The heart expansion is, you know, this is one of the things we're doing when we're doing some of the energetic practice, and also the breathing, the relaxed Shanti mind breathing meditation, where you're focused on the heart and you pull that breath into the heart and you allow it to, you know, then go out from the heart. We want to expand into bhakti, into that reverence, into devotion for Guru, not devotion to me as a person, but devotion to that divine truth which I bring, which I represent, which I speak. Devotion to that. So it's not only heart devotion to Guru, but heart devotion to God, to that truth. Doesn't matter whether you like my personality or you don't. It's not based upon personality and magnetism or any of this. It has to do with going beyond that and surrendering to that truth. And that truth is also the essence of your being. So when you're expanding in that devotion and you're offering devotion to Guru, understand you're also offering it to yourself. What I am, you are. What I am, you are. Okay? I just happen to know it consciously at this moment, and you don't as yet. That's all. It's the only difference. That's the only difference. But what I am, you are. So when people come in and you have that heart expansion and you pranam to the Guru, and you'll see in India, my students will come and they literally bow down, put their head on my foot, and some of them kiss the foot when they come in, literally. Why? Because they're surrendering. They're surrendering themselves. They're opening their heart in total surrender to that truth. And when you can totally surrender to Guru, then you also surrender to yourself, and you're able to start to move through things. You start to open up where you can hear instead of that ego in the way of, well, I know, and, you know, when you get into that intellectual, I know it, you're not surrendered, and you're not going to make very much progress. You had Ramakrishna. He was so bhakti that he became Kali. In his devotion to Kali, he saw he was no separate. He was not separate from Kali. He became Kali. That which you're utterly devoted to, you become. If there's total devotion, total surrender, you become that. This is why when you have a marriage, you absolutely devote to your partner. Have that bhakti, expanded heart. You see them as Shiva Shakti. You're utterly devoted. You're utterly surrendered. They become your divine partner. You see that divine in them. Don't look at the personality. Don't look at the things. You look beyond that. If you start honoring that divinity, you'll be amazed at what comes out. So these are the types of marriages I would like to see. People on the path. More bhakti. This is very important. It's very important if you're on this path to commit to somebody, to find someone else that is on this path. Very, very important, especially in Kundalini path. Because as you're finding out, when you're around this energy all the time, someone with an awakened Kundalini, it's going to activate your partner. They need to be aware of this. They need to be aware of this going in. It's not a joke. They need to be committed also to the path 100%. Very, very important.
Once someone has taken the Diksha, you say that that energy will run until it comes to completion. Could that be through many lives, or it depends on how devoted they are, or how much they surrender to it?
Yeah, it can take many lifetimes. It can. It depends. It depends on, like I said, yeah, absolutely how surrendered you are, how much time you put into it. If you don't complete in this lifetime, then the next lifetime, something will happen that will trigger Kundalini again, and it will start forward where you left off. This is happening to many people in this lifetime. Many people have done past life, and now they're coming in, and it's getting triggered. This is why we need more and more gurus that are willing to do what I'm doing, to work one-to-one. Because otherwise, these people can go into a psychosis. They can, you know, if it's activating and they don't know what's going on and they're chasing after mind and phenomena and they get off into it and they don't know how to stabilize. So very, very, very important to have people committed to this path, to completion, so they can go forward. And it's not always the easiest thing. I will not tell you it's easy being guru. It takes a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of commitment to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's a lot of commitment. Okay. And it can be very, very draining on your energy if you're not having enough time for meditation. It's a very fine balance in being guru. It's simple to go into meditation and stay in the very expanded state of jnana, but then you can't relate to people where they are. But if you stay too externalized, the draw on your energy is so enormous that you're physically exhausted. So this is why so many gurus, they wind up with cancer, they wind up with so many things, because it's such a strain when you're actively working with people. Like I was working with Paula the other day. You can take on some of their things and transmute it. I was taking on her stomach thing yesterday and was just running to the toilet every 5 seconds. I had to stop the car and run to the toilet again because I was picking up that, transmuting that energy for her. So that happens. And that's something you have to commit to doing. You work with people where they are. I had one devotee in Dubai, and every time he'd come and touch my feet, I would go through physical pain because he had so much stuff that was collected, so much garbage. So yeah, this is a reality. There's only one. There's only one. So when you're a guru and you're connecting with people on that level, you're taking on their stuff. It's a big commitment to do this. Not everyone is going to go forward to be a guru. It's not meant for everyone, and that's fine. That's fine. But if you can handle it, we need to have more lights in the world. We need to have more sat gurus. There are many, many gurus in the world. Every guru does not do this. Only sat gurus that are realized beings. So let's go on to the next question. Was suffering of world you experienced caused by you? Whose question was this? That's yours. Okay. Are you speaking of traumas that I went through, or what? What is it? Oh, no, that was before. Before. That wasn't when I discharged everything in realization. I didn't feel so much as much the suffering of the world as while in the process. At one point in the process, not only did I feel my own suffering, but I felt the suffering of the world, and it was such a weight that I couldn't function. Yeah.
Betty Eady is an Indian woman who had a near-death experience, and she met who she thought was Jesus during this time, and he wanted her to review her time on earth. And I believe the first part of it was the suffering that she had accumulated in her body. The second part was the suffering that she had caused, and it was like a pebble being dropped in water, and it eventually affected the whole world, and it got to a point where she could not bear it anymore. And I was just wondering if that was the same experience that you had.
Mine wasn't so much looking at what I was causing in the world, but just feeling the suffering of the world in general. It was, at that point, extremely overwhelming. It was like being crushed with heavy rocks. You couldn't breathe. It was just so heavy, so much heaviness. It took me to a point of almost not being able to go on. I was praying for death at that point. It was so overwhelmingly heavy. So overwhelmingly heavy. But not everyone is going to experience this. You have to realize when I was quite young, I I asked, most foolishly, to walk the path of Christ. So I had the experiences of that Christ had, like the suffering when he was in suffering in the garden, and that just the sweat was blood that was running. He was feeling that suffering, also suffering of the world, that suffering and this, you know. He had to feel that suffering in order to go forward and say, not my will but yours be done. If I have to do this, if you can take this cup away from me, if you can, if not, then I will continue forward and do what needs to be done. If you can take this, I was praying for death, if you can, you know, take this away. But it wasn't taken away. All of us on this path are going to go through points where it's going to seem like you cannot take another step. This is when it takes absolute surrender and trust. This is why I say build up the surrender in bhakti now. Because you will reach points in the path which are very, very difficult. I never say this is an easy path. You will reach a point of terror. It's possible. And I've spoken of this many times. My last second before realization was absolute terror. If I took another step, I would possibly reach total extinction. Either that or feeling as if you're going to be possessed. You don't know what's forward, and you know that you have no choice but to go forward. That was just a moment before realization. At that point, what I did was surrendered absolutely 100%. On the altar of truth, I lay myself. Only God can save me now, because I've done everything that I can do. I can do nothing more. I had reached that point. I can do nothing more. I've done everything I can do. It's absolute, total surrender. If possession comes, it comes. If utter extinction comes, it comes. But I was to the point of total exhaustion. I couldn't go any further. But you know you have to go. It's like walking pitch black in the Grand Canyon and knowing that ledge is there and it means death. Yet you're compelled to go. You're compelled. That inner truth is so driving, you're compelled to go. This is surrender. It's not easy. When the mind starts going through shifts of consciousness and you falls away and suddenly you're not remembering something that happened 2 minutes ago, feel like you're going through Alzheimer's and the mind will start going. You're just stepping into the now. When we say there's no past, we mean there's no past. This happens in consciousness. You go through many, many shifts of consciousness. The first time the mind stills is like a sudden revelation. It's so awe-inspiring at that moment. The first samadhi experience is so awe-inspiring at that moment. But you have so many, so many, so many shifts of consciousness along the way. Let's see what we have next. Images that come up in the mind and they're shattering. Okay. When images start coming up, what you need to do is just go into the breath and go into witness state and just see it's nothing more than that, images. Don't attach any special thing to them. Don't be repelled by them. Don't be enamored of them. It's phenomena. It's shakti. That's all. Continue on until you go into nirvikalpa where there are no images beyond mind. Images means there's still movement. There's still movement. One is still in dual realm of movement, energy. Shakti. In the Absolute, there are no images. It's where all energy comes from, but it's not energetic. It's where all light comes from, but there is no light. It's where all these things proceed from, yet within itself, you cannot say it's one or the other. Shakti is the manifestation of that. And while it's true, Shakti is not separate from Shiva. The motion is not separate from the Absolute. First, you have to get to the Absolute before it's non-dual. If you're still in duality, then you say, neti, neti, not this, not this, not this, not this, until you reach to the Absolute. So just seeing this phenomena that's coming up as discharging images, another movie, see it, witness it, okay. But stay steady. Continue to do the Shanti mind meditation, continue to do the mantras, continue to do the energy practice. Continue until there's nothing there to view, until Nirvikalpa pulls you in. And it's undeniable, is undeniable. Absolute is undeniable. After my realization, I had written to my guru, and he asked, "Are you convinced of this?" I said, "No. I'm not convinced, I'm not assured," because that takes doubt. In order to be convinced of something, there must have been some doubt, and this there is no doubt. He says, "That's it." You're there, it's time to be. That's it. It's undeniable. It's beyond doubt. It simply is. The essence of the world. If this world ends in 1 second, it doesn't matter, for this is. I am not there, nor have I ever been there as personality, and it doesn't matter if I have existence or I don't have existence in this world. It doesn't matter, for this is. Shakti may come and go, it doesn't matter, for this is. When you get to that point, then it doesn't matter. Then, okay, Shakti comes, the fragrance comes, the Leela comes. Excellent. It's transient. May appear as ups and downs. Doesn't matter, because there's that stable is that's unchanging. Pure potential. Then you realize that everything here is created by mind. Where that focus of mind is, where that intention is, that's why prayer is so very important, so very effective, because it moves. It's just, you know, what quantum is finding. There's the video out now, as Swamiji showed me when I was down there, about the man that did all these experiments with water. The crystallization of water. You've seen that. It's awesome, yeah. He takes tap water, he takes water that's sterile, and there are no crystals in it. And then they pray. And when they pray, when they hold hands, and the number of people pray, it has one pattern. And if they pray and they hold their hands together, which creates a circuit, it's even stronger. And these crystals are formed, most beautiful crystals, with the words love, the words peace, the words thank you and gratitude. This water becomes infused with these crystalline. It changes the whole dynamic of this water. they've done the experiments where they put the water in a clear bottle and write the words love on there. The most beautiful crystals come out, and they write the words hate, and there are no crystals formed. So this only substantiates what we're telling you, what, you know, that the mind is so vast. What the mind gravitates to when you're running your life around these illusions of truth, you're creating this drama that doesn't need to be. You're creating the bondage. You're sustaining the bondage. So this is why we continue to give practices to still the mind, to open the bhakti. As this changes, the mind changes, the consciousness changes. Your interaction with the world will change. So this is another thing you can do. Go home, take some bottled water. You want energy, write energy on the bottle. You want love, write love on the bottle. And it will be infused with that essence. It's been proven scientifically. Over and over again. I'll try to get that video so we can watch it. Yeah, there's also a book out that's got pictures of the crystals as they've prayed, and they've taken water samples from around the world to see what the basic properties were and then how it was infused by just this prayer and how long that prayer lasted in those waters. Very, very strong. So what your attention and your intention is putting out there is very, very strong in the world. When we say that there's a transmission that happens with Guru, we mean there's a transmission that happens with Guru. Yeah. You're over 80% water, 75-80% water it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So when you come and there's transmission, this is why we're saying darshan is so important. Coming to satsang is so important. Because the words that are being spoken here, what's being shared here, is changing your molecular structure. It's changing you at cellular level. It's changing your chemistry. Very, very, very important. When you do meditation, it's changing you. The more you surrender and you're not fighting it, it's changing you. It has a chance to take effect. If you're in ego and you already know it, then you're putting up blockages, negating what's trying to take root, take effect. So yes, very important. And the last one for today is, need more deepening for your insight. Would you like to explain that a little more?
I just think that I need more, you know, guidance, inside work, a structure to where I'm going, and coming here today, that has really helped me, just from listening what everybody had to say. That already has helped me to focus, you know, deeper to my problem.
First of all, it's not a problem. Let's not set that up. It's not a problem. What we're doing is trying to peel away the layers of coverings. Okay? So, yeah. This is why you take Diksha and then you start with the other practices as well. The mantras also help to take one to different levels of consciousness. Also the energetic practice that I'm giving out now. This is new. This has just come into being. It's not being given out anywhere else. But it's very, very strong. as you see, Siva Sundari Das can't even read it. She goes out. It's like, it's that strong. It's that strong. Swamiji was out of bliss because he's been so externalized with his work in the world, and it just one or two reps of it, he was in bliss again. It's that strong. So yeah, if you want to start to transcend, you want to have a deepening, take diksha. Continue to come for satsang. Continue to reaffirm your commitment every day and surrender. This is why I say, you know, people, you don't need to have an altar, but sometimes the altar keeps your focus as well, you know, and that surrender. And just put up something that's important and meaningful to you. It doesn't necessarily need to be like mine is, but I also have the tape that talks about this altar and what these images are representing, what the Shiva Linga represents. It represents that perfection, the absolute, that seed essence which we are going towards. That's what the Linga represents, is that absolute. And what it sits in is the Shakti, that fragrance of the world. So the bringing that together as one. It's not separate, it's non-dual, it's one. So there's a lot of representation in that. As you see, every linga has the nandi bowing down before it, in front of it. The nandi is basically, you know, animal passions. Animal passions are subservient. Okay. They need to stay in a surrendered state. Ganesh is the dispeller of obstacles. This is the first one that opens the chakra area is Ganesh. He's located in the first level. First chakra, yeah, would be Ganesh. And Ganesh is the dispeller of obstacles. And you come and always propitiate Ganesh first. So you don't come and demand it. You come and say, please open, please clear the way. May the way be cleared. And know that whatever is there is also is within your being. You are not separate from Ganesh. You are not separate from Shakti. You are not separate from any of these. And Kali is the one that cuts the head of illusion. Cuts the mind. Cuts these things at the root. This is why I use Kali. She's very strong, very just in that... She's the one that, you know, she can be the Divine Mother. When life comes into the world, so does death. She's time. She's also the one that's the greatest boon for devotees, if you understand what she is. If you can get beyond that fear. So the external appearance and the things that you go on the path can be very, very fearsome when they're coming up. If you can get beyond that, you can reach to realization. So Kali's function, we'll give this real quick in the Chandipat, as all of the gods got together, Krishna, Rama, Shiva. The demons were overtaking the world. They were overtaking the heavenlies. And they got together and pooled their energies and created Shakti. And Shakti was fighting all the demons of envy, mind, all of these things were coming up. The demons were all having to do with emotional things. Envy, anger, separation, all these negatives. So Shakti, the Devi, Durga, is fighting all of these demons. The most difficult one to overcome was ego. And the ideas of mind, when she would cut the head of one, the blood would come out and sprout. And what were we talking about? The blood carries whatever you've got within. And as it was hitting the ground, another thought would grow, or another one would manifest, another demon. So Durga pooled her energies in even more concentrated, and out popped Kali. She's the distilled essence of that, which cuts through all of this drama. And Kali would open her mouth and drink the blood and get rid of these things before they had a chance to hit the ground and manifest again. She nipped it in the bud before it had a chance to sprout. That's her function. And the last one that she fought was ego, the illusion of being a me, a separate self. Cut that head. And that's liberation. Once you find out I am not this body, there is liberation. When you find out I am not this, there is liberation. She takes one to liberation. So even though her image can be quite fearful, and it's very fearful when she starts letting go and surrendering, fear of the unknown, fear of all these fears come up. That's why they show her being such a fearful image. Because this path, you're facing your fears, you're facing all of these things, going beyond it, cutting the head of it, and then getting rid of it before it has a chance to sprout. We're not going to give it ground to sprout.
That the healthy ego is the one that just identifies with being a child of God. And you were saying that at a certain point there's just one, there is no you at all. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
As long as you think you're the body form, there's a sense of ego, okay? So yeah, if you have to identify with something, identify with being either a child of God or, like I said, that bhakti, surrender to Guru, surrender to this, you know. Keep that ego subservient until you find out that the ego was an illusion. The me is an illusion. It's just a movement of Shakti in the world. Okay? But it's not the totality of who and what you are. You are not what you thought you were. You're much more vast than can be imagined. So yeah, that's... There's a difference between thinking ego and being egotistical. Ego is just identification with form and separation. It's not necessarily a bad word. It just means that you're still identified with form, identified with the transient, have not reached the non-dual as yet, where that falls away. So I think that was a pretty productive satsang today. And so next week, if you come and you bring your questions that you have that arise throughout the week, we'll do this again. I have to check what the date is, but yeah, we'll look today and we'll set up a Diksha date for you. Okay. So, yeah, that's possible. We'll set up your Diksha time. Absolutely. And now we're going to spend some time in meditation. So if we want to take a quick break, we'll take a few minutes break to have restroom breaks or whatever else we need to do. And then we'll have some meditation time. All right, I thought we were done. I guess we're not done. So you were asking about gurus doing things to throw a wrench in the works with people's ideas. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is what I did, like I said, in Dubai. I went over and was in the traditional orange and no makeup and the real shaved head and everything, and that was great. But the minute I started breakthrough some conditionings to expand that, some people fell away. But what changes? What's changed? If you're in makeup, if you're not, what's changed? Has the consciousness changed? Consciousness has not changed. People need to get beyond these externals. If Nisargadatta smoked, did it mean that he was less enlightened? Some people will judge that. Has nothing to do with this conscious awareness. Absolutely not. And this is another thing I did when we were in Dubai. I don't smoke. Never smoke. We went to the Shisha place. She see bad? I brought back a hookah. We went to the Shisha place. They smoke, you get higher than a kite from this stuff. It's not that it has cherris or, you know, any ganja or marijuana in it. Nothing. It's just the way the tobacco is done and the way it is. It makes them higher than a kite. So, okay, we'll go. I had people there that were, you know, one is a big smoker, heavy smoker. Another one doesn't smoke at all. They got higher than a kite, and I was nothing. I smoked them under the table just to prove a point. This is consciousness. I can either get high or not get high from it. Doesn't matter. It's where my consciousness is, what happens. So, yeah, I smoked them under the table. To why? To prove a point. This is a demonstration, you know, this is consciousness. Noel fixed me an alcoholic beverage the other night, a grasshopper. It was a huge mug like this. I drank it down, nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And when I was in the path, if I would have had any kind of alcoholic thing, I would have been just blotto under the table. I mean, just... Now, nothing. So, yeah, I mean, it depends on where your consciousness is. Once you reach a certain level, these things for realized masters, it doesn't matter. It's like the one Ram Dass went and took and gave, Neem Karoli Baba, I think it was, gave him the LSD. And it was like nothing. His leg, he took it and says, yeah, now, so, what? It's just another phenomena. It's nothing. So, yeah, sometimes they do it, you know, as an act of demonstration. It's like, and you're so attached to this, why? So, no, it doesn't matter. This is why they say, you know, in one part of the... not the Ashtavakra, there's another one by Sankacharya. But it says you can't judge a realized being by the externals. One of them may be like a snake just sitting there and not doing much. Another can be very active in the world. One can always be in meditation, another can be active in the world, another one will see him like he's stonewall crazy. You can't judge it by the external appearance of what's happening, because it all has to do with where is their consciousness. Well, it's also, yeah, what your mind projects. Yeah, there are a lot of people, and like I said, if I say something, 10 people will hear it 10 different ways according to their past experience, according to their depth, their level of knowledge. They'll get something. Some will hear just the very surface level, and other people will hear a depth to it. So, yeah. I do things all the time to shake people up because I want to break them out of their box. Quit boxing yourself in. Yeah, drive you crazy trying to figure out what's going on. Don't get attached. I've talked to them about this before. I've gone to speak at some place with full sannyas clothes, with the orange, with makeup on and a wig. Say, that's not what you were expecting, was it? Good, get beyond your expectations. This is why you see me now, you know. People will, oh, you're wearing sannyas, well, you're trying to be special. There's nothing to do with that. I'm sitting here in clothes now. I'm wearing a lot more of the Kali colors. The red and the black is very tantric colors. And this is also a very tantric path. What you're being taught here is tantra. Tantra is nothing more than using everything in life to reach realization. There's nothing separate from the path. That's tantra. It has nothing to do with this, you know, what they're teaching in the West that it's sex, or what they believe in India that it's black magic. You know, those are people that are using perversions of it. They don't understand the whole of it. So it goes to what's the difference if I'm sitting here in makeup or if I have my head shaved and I'm wearing orange robes. You need to get beyond the external perceptions. I want sannyas to be of the heart, not of an external appearance. Because then you're not renounced to anything. You're just entering, into another, you know, another conditioned idea. Yeah, some people do. They hide behind it. So this is why you see me now mostly wearing, going into another change, wearing a lot of the blacks and the red, the tantric colors. Because this is my path. This is my name, Kali, Uttamananda Giri. Fully realized yet functional in the world, this aspect of Kali, this straightforward dynamic energy. What a character. You look very Kali today. Sitting there in your red shirt and your black pants. Look at this. Yeah, what is this? Everybody, look at this. We got a lot of the reds and blacks today. The Kali crew, yeah. Yeah, that's okay too. Yeah. Once they reach my level, what's the next step? Who's bringing me higher? There is no who at that point. It's just the flow of the universe, that's all. At that point, you're with the flow of the universe. Do we think this planet is basic training? Sort of. When you reach to the state of realization, you could either choose to come back in and help the world or work from the other side, or just totally let go and absorb back into absolute. But there's no right or wrong in it, that it has to be one way or another. There's liberation. This is what liberation means. You're liberated. So you don't go to another planet where you're the low rung of realization and there are other higher. Remains to be seen. Just go with the flow. There are levels and levels and levels and levels and layers and layers and layers. Unending. Whatever the mind can conceive of, it's there. Okay? So if that's what you're after, is to go to, you know, more and more exotic layers, you can do that. There's, you know, you can't get any more basic than the absolute. What is reality? It's reality. It doesn't matter how many planes you go. It's still the same reality. That's not going to change. Absolute is absolute. It's just the transient experience will be different on different planes, but absolute is standard. No matter where you go, it's absolute is standard. It's the foundation of everything. You sort of get it. Yeah, that's it. You're thinking too much. Yeah, people are so worried about other planes, and they haven't even managed this one yet. First, manage this one, and then the rest of all those questions are going to fall away. As unimportant. Unimportant.